Racing hasn't changed and it never will.
It doesn't matter if racing never changes. What matters is if we let racing change us. Every one of us has to find a reason to do this. You don't climb into a T-180 to be a driver. You do it because you're driven.
If you know so much, why don't you tell me why I should keep driving?
Sorry. That's for you to figure out. I just hope when you do, that I'm there to see it.
Official IE Cinema Podcast. I'm your host, David Carter, and I'm going to keep this introduction pretty short because we have a doozy of an episode for you this week. It is an hour-long conversation with the wonderful, lovely Margot Stacey, formerly of the apparel store Tees on Sin, currently of the Instagram account Mise on Sin, and she will give you a lovely introduction as to what she does and what she is currently doing and what her future holds as we talk about for a very long time the 2008 film Speed Racer, because this is Speed Racer week, at least it is to me, at the Indiana University Cinema. I am actually going to keep this introduction so short that there won't even be a dedicated schedule episode, but I will let you know about the two other screenings happening at the IU Cinema this week. On Tuesday, March 22nd at 7 p.m., we have a virtual event, which is free and no ticket required. We have The Cleaners. This is part of our National Evening of Science on Screen program. There will be a post-film discussion, Delete, Ignore, Delete, what happens when Silicon Valley cleans the internet, and that will be immediately after the virtual screening. Go to the Cleaners page on the IU Cinema website to get all the information about how you can participate in this virtual event, including things like downloading Zoom software, registering for the March 22nd Zoom seminar. We'll have all your questions answered there, and you will find more information on the screening on the IU Cinema website. Our newest regular blog contributor, Noni Ford, just wrote a piece on The Cleaners that you should go check out on the A Place for Film blog. And once again, that is Tuesday, March 22nd at 7 p.m., and it is a virtual event, and it is free, and there's no ticket required. And then on Thursday, March 24th, we have an in-person event at 7 p.m. For $4. We have the next film in our 5 by Douglas Sirk Magnificently Obsessed series. We have the titular Magnificent Obsession. And just some things about that. As usual, due to our limited screening schedule and currently reduced seating capacity, we strongly encourage patrons to buy tickets online in advance to avoid getting sold out, and there is no standby or late seating. If you want more information on who Douglas Sirk is, go check out me and our publications editor, Michaela Owens, episode on an introduction to Douglas Sirk. But a brief description of this film: Douglas Sirk's first Technicolor tearjerker with Universal also marked the beginning of the legendary stardom of Rock Hudson, when Playboy millionaire Bob Merrick, played by Hudson, causes a series of accidents that leave socialite Helen Phillips, played by Jane Wyman, widowed and blind. He vows to right his wrongs by paying his fortune forward, going to medical school, and curing Helen's blindness. Shot in lurid color and lushly scored by longtime Sirk collaborator Frank Skinner, the film features a leading couple for the ages. And once again, that is playing on Thursday, March 24th at 7 p.m., please come out to that. These are Douglas Sirk films. They are beautiful, and they look incredible on the big screen. And then finally, just so you know when it all is, on Friday, March 25th, we finally have my staff select screening of Speed Racer at 7 p.m. It is $4. Same rules as the in-person screening for Douglas Sirk. Just get your tickets in advance, and I've invited a lot of people to this, so if you're listening to this on Monday and you really want to come, go ahead and just buy your ticket right now. But as per the description that Brittany had me write months and months ago, I have not read this out loud, so let's do it right now. This is from 2008. I have decided to play it on a 2K DCP instead of film because this was never shot on film. This was shot digitally. I think it's truer to the vision of what Lily and Lana were going for, but directed by Lily and Lana Wachowski. From their unbridled minds comes the phantasmagorical tour de force about cars, commerce, and family. Adapting Tetsuo Yoshida's manga and anime of the same name, Speed Racer is a story of the Racer family and their son Speed's journey to restore his family's name after their oldest son, Rex, gets caught up in a web of corruption involving Royalton Industries and its CEO, Arnold Royalton. With the help of the enigmatic Racer X, Speed not only fights to become the finest race car driver the world has ever seen, but also for the art form of racing itself. Me and Margo get more into that in our following discussion. So, once again, that's going to be this Friday at 7 p.m. And I just want to say it's going to be a very special evening. I've been looking forward to introducing this film and getting it played for the public for a very long time. And I have some things to say that I hope all of you will be there for. But without further ado, we have a very lengthy conversation with Margo Stacey. I think you will love it. We weave in and out. There's a long preamble where we talk about The Matrix and The Matrix films before we even get to talking about Speed Racer. I think it's a vital part of the conversation, but please sit back, relax, and enjoy a conversation on Speed Racer with the great and lovely Margo Stacey.
I say, yeah, buddy. Rolling like a big shot, Chevy tuned up like a NASCAR pit stop. Fresh paint job, fresh inside. Is the outside frame in the trunk wide? Are the rims big? Do it ride good. Lean back, right hand on the firewood.
Hi, I'm Margo Stacey. I like movies. I don't necessarily identify as a cinephile anymore, mainly because I don't want to be associated with film Twitter. But I, in the past, have run a t-shirt company called Tees on Sin, and I think that's how David and I connected. Since then, I have closed that store down other than some minor operational things just to make some side cash. But other than that, I run an Instagram page called Mise en Scène, and it's Mise as in miscellaneous, because I'm really interested in film, but also film's relationship with fashion, film's relationship with image, which sounds redundant, but I think that images are things themselves, and so I'm very interested in analyzing those things and sharing those things in a sort of esoteric way. Also, I'm just very obsessive, so it's just a good outlet for me to share the things that just fill my mind day to day, other than work and family and paying the bills. So yeah, that's me. I don't know what else to say.
Margo. Brevere introduction for yourself. I love it. Thank you so much. That was perfect.
Great.
Thank you so much for being here. As Margo said, yes, I knew Margo when you were just an anonymous person behind an avatar on Twitter.com. I just loved following you. I thought you were hilarious. Oh. Obviously, love the things that you were producing. Thought you were intelligent and smart.
Keep going.
Well, looking at you, very beautiful. You guys can't see, Margo is very beautiful.
Thank you.
And very eloquent. But this is all to say that, yes, I had wanted to talk to you for some time. Obviously, there was a level of obsession in that we did do a whole farewell episode to Tees on Sin on this podcast.
It's still in my anonymity, which is fantastic, because I remember listening to it and just wanting to be known, but also not wanting to be known. So yes, that was really lovely of you to do that.
Oh, it was easy. Me and my former co-hosts, you have so much of our money in your pocket. Let's put it that way.
It's not there anymore.
It's not there anymore. Good. But thank you for being here. And as I was always trying to think of like guests that I would always have on an episode about this particular movie, because we're talking about Speed Racer today, if I already didn't say that up front before Margo got here, I knew I wanted somebody on who wanted to go less into the, because I appreciate you saying that you like thinking about like image and looks and fashion and the aesthetics of film, because I think aesthetics are so important to Speed Racer, and I definitely wanted to have somebody on who had an eye for aesthetics more than someone who had an eye for the subtext within the film, which is not even so. I mean, most of the subtext in Speed Racer is just text, so would make for a very interesting episode to begin with, because I don't think you really need to be a grad student to understand that it's an anti-capitalist movie.
Absolutely.
I felt like that would kind of get monotonous, but thank you so much for being on here.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. I'm so excited. I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
So, Margo, I wanted to ask you, what is your relationship with this movie? Did you see it when it came out May 9th, 2008? You know,
what are your relationships with the Wachowskis, if any? Is this the only movie of theirs that you even like? You know, I'm always interested in stuff like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I did not see it when it opened up. I didn't see it till 5-ish years ago. I mean, to think of that movie as almost 15 years old is insane. But yeah, the Wachowskis I've always had a very meaningful relationship to their films. I think Speed Racer came to me late because in 2008, I was not really into movies. You know, I'd see the whatever was opening. And so, yeah, I was completely unaware of Speed Racer. You know, so for how old are you?
I'm turning 32 soon.
Okay, perfect. Months. We're the same age. We're the same generation. We're the kind of late millennials. But yeah, so, and I don't know if you had this similar experience, but I think my first DVD was actually The Matrix. I remember.
This was the first DVD that was in our house, my older brother.
Okay. So like, I literally remember like when DVDs started like being produced, this like very strange looking movie, this like, and I did not obviously see The Matrix in the movie theaters. I would have been 11, but yeah, I remember that being our first DVD in the house, at least one of the first ones we had. The like cardboard with the plastic clip, it was very delectable if you had no idea what it was. And so I'm sure I watch, you know, most movies that I watched as a teenager were just on a laptop, on my parents' laptop in my bedroom. That's probably the first way I watched The Matrix. But The Matrix has obviously always just been a touchstone for me. And my relationship with the Wachowskis began there. And so since then is just obviously, you know, as somebody who's interested in their filmography, somebody interested in not just their filmography and not just their like intellectual relationship to movies, but like you mentioned earlier, like an aesthetic relationship, like a very pure aesthetic relationship that I think, especially from a perspective of these, for so long they were the Warner Brothers like studio, they were the people,
yeah
the breadwinners, if you will. And so yeah, The Matrix for me was like, it was the rabbit hole, right? Because you'd never seen a movie like that before. You'd never seen a movie so cool. The aesthetic was not, because of their vision, it was definitely not something mainstream, even though they were mainstream filmmakers. And there was a period of my life where like that was like a childhood thing. And then because I wasn't really into movies for a long time, I didn't just go seek out directors and things and like their new films and stuff like that until I was in like college and into my adulthood, which I'm very glad I didn't get into movies until later in life, because I just feel like I have a wiser posture toward filmmaking. And not saying that I'm wise, but I'm saying there's just a different perspective you have when you have some experience in life and you come to a thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I grew up in the South. We didn't have like access to like movie theater. I mean, like the big movie theater that like would have shown like a 10-plex or something like that would have been 2 hours away from me. So everything was on DVD. And yeah, that period of time not watching movies, not really thinking about them other than just like a general mainstream audience member was, yeah, Groomy, what were you going to say about that? I'm interested.
Well, I was just going to say we have very kind of similar backgrounds in that while I did see this movie when it came out in 2008 and it was very like pivotal screening for me in life, I actually didn't get into movies until I went to college. I just happened to have friends in music school who were into film. They grew up on the West Coast, just had a very different like culture, like art culture upbringing than I did, because I grew up in the Midwest. And so I didn't come to film until like I was in college. So I really appreciate you talking about like the idea of appreciating art when your brain is more fully developed in a way, mostly because I think the way that has probably shaped at least my outlook on like watching films from an aesthetic point of view, or just the point of view of someone who is both legally and mentally an adult, is that I tend to seek out more interesting things and less things for comfort. I guess is kind of how I look at it. Just meaning like, yes, I obviously do have the things that I go to for comfort all the time, but I tend to want to look for things that are trying to like challenge me in some way, and not in like a, like, I need to be shocked, I need to see the most fucked up thing possible, but just meaning like something that like I might not agree with at a glance, but then see how it changes and shapes and grows in my mind as like time goes by, or through rewatches or looking at other directors' works or whatever, things like that. And also that same thing, like I wasn't aware of what directors did what growing up in high school. So like seeing this, like, yes, I knew the name Wachowski because like I saw V for Vendetta and I had seen the Matrix trilogy. I would say this is probably the movie that made it be like, oh, well, I'll see whatever they make from now on, even though I don't know a lot about them. I'll just see whatever they make. It sounds like a good time. I mean, I guess like sort of my relationship with this movie is I did see it opening day. I mean, this has kind of been like well-worn territory, especially if you're on the internet. Like, this movie came out. It was widely hated. No one liked it except for like the small group of people who like started championing it. That group of people essentially became like the new gatekeepers of the internet. And so here we are now, 14 years later, almost 15 years, where I would say at least within an artistic canon or like artistic forms, like Speed Racer is no longer this like underrated masterpiece.
Oh,
I think at this point, people just understand like this was a movie that was misunderstood in its time. And those who end up watching it now in the year 2022, because so many movies have directly borrowed from it, or you know, it's still like decades ahead of where movie imaginations could be, and it's a direct assault against like the aesthetics of the Matrix and all this stuff. Like at this point, I would just say that people would just consider Speed Racer a good movie. I don't know if everyone considered a masterpiece. They're just like, no, it's just like a good, fun movie. You don't have to think about it very much if you don't want to, but if you do want to think about it, there are things for you there to discover. And so, yeah, my relationship with this movie is that I have evangelized it for years and years and years. Amongst like my friends and family. That's why I'm showing it at the IU Cinema. And throughout that time, I guess the one thing that people will constantly ask me when they say, well, like, what makes it so good? Because, you know, from my point of view, that is a movie made for children, you know, or it looks aggressively fake, or, you know, it looks like aggressively stilted. And there's always like the canned arguments of like, well, it's based on an anime from the late 60s. And it's like all very like, you know, and it's true. It's like all very like stylistic choice and all these things. And they're going for and anti-realism and stuff. But I think what I have now come to when answering that question is I just tell people, I'm like, just imagine that you're watching a movie with the like steady hand that the person behind the wheel knows exactly what they're doing, and they want to show you the most insane thing you've ever seen in your entire life.
Sure.
That is how I describe it to people, just because, yes, you have two master filmmakers who are coming off The Matrix, and this is just all me having watched them give interviews and things, which is obviously a newer thing because there were years and years and years they never gave interviews.
Yeah.
And then I would say right after Cloud Atlas, it wasn't like they would do tons of press junkets or anything like that, but they've become much more open in speaking to the public about things and about their works. But they've talked very openly about doing the Matrix trilogy and kind of feeling like they were had been trapped in this like aesthetic cage that they had trapped themselves in because they were just trying to like do something different with each movie. But at the same time, like they kind of had to adhere to the whole everything's tinted green. Everything is artificial. Everything. I think recently Lana just did like an interview for Matrix Resurrections. She talked about how she used to be afraid of the sun and like none of the Matrix movies have any natural light in them because the sun is like this variable, and since then she's like learned to embrace the sun. And so like when you watch the Matrix trilogy, there's all this like the lighting is very artificial in those movies.
Sure.
And so they talked about that and being just kind of like done, and then also the like weird side effect of making, you know, a movie that everyone just perceived to copy. Everything started to look like the Matrix, like their direct Bill Pope's cinematography, the set design, like everything. Christopher Nolan movies, all those Batman movies, they look just like The Matrix.
Yeah, it's definitely a watershed moment in the sense of like, if you have these, like, especially in American cinema, you have, you know, just thinking of the last generation of movies, you think about like Pulp Fiction and its influence and its reverberations through what became a mainstream mode. Yeah, The Matrix for sure definitely resonated. And again, it's so funny to think of them as these blockbuster, like studio darling filmmakers that, you know, I think so much, and it's in Speed Racer too, not to get off of what we're talking about now, but it is in Speed Racer too, this kind of like this dialectic of art and commerce. And they are some of the most commercial American filmmakers in the last 30 years. And, you know, it's such an interesting space to have to exist in constantly.
It's funny because it's a space like not, you know, to compare it to them feeling like they got trapped in their own cage with the Matrix trilogy. Mm-hmm. They are filmmakers who have chosen to only work at the highest budget level a director can work. Like, for they haven't made a movie that's cost less than $100 million since the first Matrix movie, which cost less than $100 million. Like, all of their movies are like these blockbusters. I think they're kind of akin to like a John Borman, you know, these people who are like can only make spectacles, and if they can't make the spectacle, then they just won't make the movie. And yet,
do it.
But somehow, despite them not really having a hit since the second Matrix movie, mm-hmm. they continue to operate at that level no matter what. It's like fascinating. And they're conscious of it. Lana has talked about the absurdity of what she does as like a filmmaker making big blockbuster movies that either no one goes to see it, and if they do go see them, they hate them, essentially. Yeah. But I just wanted to get back to the idea that they make the Matrix trilogy, they need something different, and everything is looking like the Matrix. So they make a movie designed specifically to assault the aesthetics of the Matrix, which had become the dominant aesthetic in early 21st century. Bush era cinema owes a lot to the Matrix, weirdly enough, despite, you know, the Matrix being like this very end of history movie, and like it's not exactly predicting what the world would come to be, but it's, I don't know, it's highlighting certain elements that would become bigger parts of our lives as we go further and further and further. And then it's just kind of interesting that the aesthetic of the early 21st century, when this idea that we're about to go through this like huge post 9/11 happens, there's this like huge shift in culture, that everything is still looking back at like this last moment in 20th century history, mm-hmm. and which like this like weird watershed moment where the interests and ideologies of like these two kind of countercultural trans women directors like all lined up with what the cultural zeitgeist wanted. Like, so the culture kept coasting off of that for like, you know, the next 10 to 15 to 20 years or whatever. And so they make Speed Racer as a kind of a direct answer to that.
Right.
That's why I find it fascinating.
No, it's absolutely fascinating. And to think of the Matrix, specifically the first one, but the trilogy itself, as this, I mean, it's obviously a seminal artifact for just our modern art making, and even like political art making, because it did take this like interesting form. So I grew up evangelical. I remember it being used as like a sermon prompt, you know, constantly, this like red pill, blue pill sort of thing. And so it found its tendrils into like, you know, nearly every I mean, there was a time there that the Matrix, and by proxy, I guess the Wachowskis, were just not just an art because of the like philosophical attitude they had in their filmmaking and in this movie, in those movies specifically. Like, they just found their ways into like, you know, it's funny, you put a thing out, a piece of art, and the beauty and terror of it at the same time is that anyone can access it. It really is why art is captivating and why we continue to make it, because as commercial as these things can be, they do find their ways into society, into culture, that like they do just seep into, you know, the cultural imagination in these odd ways. And so, you know, you can have on one hand these leftists, you know, there's a dialectic in who they are just as filmmakers, you know, they're leftist anti-capitalist, but they are given the biggest budgets in the world. They make this very like, I think sort of like the memed version of the Matrix gets a bit pallid and like drowned out, especially whenever like the last couple of years we've had this whole kind of awakening of the Wachowskis and their personal journeys, specifically, you know, regarding their transitions. But because you have like the Netflix film account that's like, you know, theorizing on all this trans ideology and stuff within the films. And then on the other side of that, which is in its own way strange and gross and odd, you know, and sort of like cynical. And then on the other hand, you have it in 4chan chat rooms or whatever, you know, not, I'm not going to act like I'm very versed in it. And I think it's, that's why, the, you know, the Matrix is so interesting. And the Wachowskis as these culture figures are so interesting because like, they've made these films that, you know, we can talk about the Matrix. We'll get to, you know, we'll talk about Speed Racer, these things that just like seep, you know, that just naturally like ooze into our consciousness in a way that like, one, is very hard to do for any person making art, and two, especially for a very commercial filmmaker. And I think that's so interesting. And like, you can critique the Wachowskis for a lot of things, but I think just within the space that they occupy over the last 20 plus years of art making and commerce and everything, they're just a very an idiosyncratic couple of filmmakers who kind of stand alone. And I think they've had to like really brave a lot of waters that like no other filmmaker ever has within the history of filmmaking. And I don't mean that in a way to like as a hagiography, but just in a general, like a general sense of like everything they did. And, we'll, you know, obviously we're talking about Speed Racer, everything they did came up against these like barriers that one, you might not have known were there, but two, that they had to like wrestle with kind of alone, which is very interesting to me.
I mean, they are pioneers, like by definition of the Absolutely. Word, like
literally, yes.
Oh, there's the technological people talk about, like, not even just the Matrix. People like to make fun of the Matrix trilogy, but like, I've heard multiple stories and watched multiple videos of being like, oh yeah, that thing from like the Burly Brawl sequence with all the Agent Smiths. They were like, yeah, they wanted it to be like bullet time, but we couldn't figure out wasn't possible. So we essentially built a computer program that's the basis of all CGI computer programs that we use today. You know, you hear stories like that.
Yeah.
And then same with Speed Racer, like them like making essentially what is a completely green screen movie, like at the time, like wasn't unheard of, but at the same time, something at this like production level meant for like something this wide of an audience. Definitely not the case. And now, you know, we learned the wrong lessons from things. And now almost 30 Marvel movies where I'm sure a majority of them are just shot on either an Atlanta parking lot mm-hmm. or on a green screen.
On a green screen,
like,
yeah.
And there aren't any real artifacts to be found except for like maybe the actor in the screen, like, you know, in the shot or whatever. Mm-hmm. So
absolutely.
They're pioneers in that. And then they're just also, you know, they're pioneers in like a lot of different ways, like even from like the like most surface level of like, it's easy to watch movies from like the past decades, like they're remarking on like the art itself, they're remarking on like itself as a franchise, and it's like Matrix Reloaded came out in 2003, like quite literally like yeah. a movie that's like in conversation with itself as a movie, not just like as a piece of philosophy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They pioneer all these things, and you know, not to say like, and they don't get the credit they deserve, but is to say that like, given the circumstances that they had to go through in Hollywood, especially at this time, because this is, you know, not to bring up Dirty Laundry or anything, I just remember this kind of vividly. I don't remember if it was Entertainment Weekly or us. I can't remember what tabloid magazine it was, but like, this was the point, like right before Speed Racer came out or like immediately after, like where Lana was transitioning.
Yeah.
And it was that weird snuff piece mm-hmm. that was like put out where they were essentially like hounding her or whatever.
Yeah.
So at the time, like, she's trying to make this with her sister, that's happening. And she's just trying to break free, like, the bounds of, like, probably a lot of people in boardrooms screaming at them, like, hey, you made this thing that made us a lot of money. I know people didn't like the other two versions of it that you made, but, like, you should make something like that again. And then them just very transgressively saying, like, no, like, we're going to make a all green screen PG, a movie for children, essentially, yeah. is what Speed Racer is. And we're going to doing a direct assault on whatever the popular aesthetic is at the time, which at the time is The Matrix. It's 2008, and we're still doing The Matrix, and The Dark Knight's going to come out a few months after this, because this movie comes out in May, and The Dark Knight comes out in, like, July or something like that,
yeah.
which is directly cribbing from The Matrix, and it's going to be sincere. This is where the Speed Racer for me is where they hard shift from into being, like, these are utopian filmmakers,
mm-hmm.
just meaning, like, from that point forth, none of their movies have like the same sort of like dour aesthetics or reservedness as The Matrix does, which I know is like by design, but it also, they have already, both of them have remarked about like that also being a symptom of them themselves being reserved and yeah. like trying to be as methodical about things as possible.
Yeah.
When you hit Speed Racer, like that's kind of gone. Like they never really go back to that. Obviously, like the philosophizing is still present in some of their movies and like kind of the stilted nature of talking and theme or whatever. But yeah. yeah, from that point forward, like the way people talk and behave and move, like it's much more either heightened or it's much more naturalistic than I would yeah. say The Matrix was.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. The Matrix was their second film after Bound.
Yes,
right?
Which Bound, you know, gets written out of history for some reason. It was really funny. I was reading, I think it's pronounced Cale M. Keegan, the professor mm-hmm. of gender studies.
Yeah, he's great.
I would love to talk to him someday. But I was reading his book on the Wachowskis, and there was this part of the book where Lana brings up that it's really funny, obviously, when they're making Bound, they're presenting as men, and like as cis straight men. I don't know if you've looked up a picture of you, which you should or should not, it's up to you, a picture of pre-transition Lily and Lana Wachowski, but like,
oh yeah, I've seen their picture.
Very
yeah.
much like people you would see in a Chicago comic book shop, you know. Yes. I don't know. So they make this movie, which like this riff, you know, this neo-noir, and it's a piece of queer cinema that's not recognized as a piece of queer cinema until they transition. And she talks right. about like how funny that is, considering like to them, and she's not taking anything away from other queer filmmakers who are making like positive representations of queer relationships, but she points out, it's like, we made a sex positive queer film that has a happy ending.
Yeah.
And queer critics at the time just kind of shrugged at it.
Yeah.
You know, she kind of thinks it's funny. She could never figure out why, outside of talk about aesthetics, they like, probably because of the way they were just presenting at the time. Right. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, had they presented something else, I'm sure it bound would be taught in every like gender studies film class, every queer cinema film class is like, I don't know.
Yeah, which is another point to, I mean, we're kind of talking around this.
We're talking around Speed Racer a little bit.
We're talking around Speed Racer, but this like idea that we're talking about, I find very interesting, because personally you and I have both talked about how we didn't come to movies till later in life, that later in life as if we're like 80, but like later in our adulthood. we didn't come to this art form until we were adults, and I think it's a fascinating subject to talk about, when especially, and then we talk about the Wachowskis' film, their movies and their filmography, and like how it's almost like so many of their movies are these touchstones that like that deny their situation in which they're made in a way. And because, like, not to beat any point over the head, but because like you make a thing and it's like sealed in time at this point, you know, the way we talk about movies and their production is we look at the years they were made, but we don't talk like a lot of the way we don't talk about. And this is where my fascinations come in, is like these movies as artifacts, these movies as things that like grow and build over time, because like people come to them at different times. And I think that's more fascinating. And so like to have these very crystallized in time images of themselves, of the movie, of the production. But then now, like, you can still, like, the whole point of like art making is that you can access it. And, you know, in our modern worlds, you can literally access it whenever, especially a mainstream film and mainstream filmmakers. But yeah, these things, these artifacts, ourselves, like, that's what I really find interesting about the Wachowskis, is like, they've always made movies that like aren't on these linear ways of thinking. They deny that. And so we can talk about Bound, we can talk about the Wachowskis transitioning and that relationship to that movie and that artifact, because now, you know, they can be considered something else than they were then. And so we can take that one thing they made and kind of like push it around their, you know, so it's like this really like mind melting way to think about art making and to think about like these objects, because they are objects that move with us and we move with them and we're in conversation with constantly if we want to be. But I think for us, as like, we're fans, we're, you know, I wouldn't call myself a critic. You are more properly so. But we also are in this conversation if we want to be. And so, like, we can, like, engage with them on their, like, timeline and their, like, constant, I don't know, I don't want to keep saying seep, it's a gross word, but, like, the way these things just, they're malleable, you know, we're malleable. And I think that is so, I think, again, that's why it's so interesting that they are mainstream filmmakers. They're mainstream filmmakers who transitioned in the public eye of their own accord, like, or of their own narrative. No, because I don't remember which one of them, Lana or Lily, was outed through The Sun or some like tabloid or something.
It was Lana. That's okay.
That's what you referred to earlier.
Yeah, that's what I'm remembering, like, in high school, the director of The Matrix, seen with like a dominatrix or something like that. Right. Just being like, oh, I just even remember at the time, like, I don't know if I should be reading this.
Right. No, absolutely. And it's so interesting. And for them to have to like work through these personal things as they're making films, in which we can talk about, like, when we get to Speed Racer, you know, like, that's all there. And I think they're just slippery is the thing. It's like, because they're slipping through time, because transition means you're actually like slipping through, you know, yourself and people's like perception of you. And it is a strange, like, I think it just, that's why they're so unique and why talking about them is, you know, I don't know what else to say about it other than I think no matter what, if you're aware when you talk about a filmmakers like the Wachowskis and their films, and then you start, we've been talking about these like personal things with how we grew up around these art pieces. Like there's some coherence there that's so strange and so sort of miraculous in the way you talk about it, because it becomes something more than the things themselves, you know? And
absolutely.
I think that's why it's also like so exciting to have, like, I, for one, like the new Matrix Resurrections. You know, a lot of people didn't, which is fine. But I think it is like really genuinely to have a Wachowski making a new movie is so fascinating, because they're going to do it in a way that's challenging and smart, and that, you know, so much of what they do is part of a narrative of art making in the last few decades that, like, you just cannot get away from. And I think it's just rife and it's riddled with conundrum and dialectic and strange things that can take you anywhere, really.
Well, I think what you so beautifully just illustrated, talking about the transitive nature of time and how fluid it is, and how, you know, the past informs the present and the future is always in dialogue with the past and things like that, is it's in itself how Speed Racer is structured, you know. For those who haven't seen the movie and are interested in seeing it at the cinema this Friday, like, one of the radical things that they did with this movie, Lana talks about, is that she had said, like, when you are watching a movie and there's an edit, a cut, it's like a period at the end of a sentence or an exclamation mark or a question mark or whatever. It's a piece of punctuation.
Yes, I have this pulled up on my phone right now. So
yes, yeah. Is it that, like, it's like, I don't think in sentences. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like a stream of conscious thing. And she doesn't really say this, but what I have expounded upon from that quote is that the way your brain works is that you're thinking about a thing, but, like, you're thinking about a thing right now. What if you were to think about that thing 2 years from now? Would you mm-hmm. feel differently about it 2 years from now than when you were thinking about it now? And you think about something from the past. That is how our brains typically work when we're having, like, thoughts and feelings and, like, telling stories. And, like, when you tell a story, you never tell a story like point A to B to C to D. Like,
right.
There are diversions, there are tangents, you go back, you know, mm-hmm. to before the story, like, oh yeah, I forgot to mention, like, 6 months before that, etc., etc. That's how storytelling actually works. So what they tried to do with Speed Racer is that the way it is edited is that it's like a cubist piece of art. They have said as much. They were inspired by cubism and Picasso. And that, yes, you will be watching a race, and during the race, they will flashback to past, you know, with match cuts and things like that. And then they will go back forward to the race, but then, you know, a character will start talking, and that will lead to, like, a memory of how they met as little children that then informs what happens next in the race. Like, things just kind of weave in and out of each other. And it's not as disorienting as you think it's going to be having someone describe it to you that way. It actually flows really nicely. And actually, in a way, I haven't really seen any other movies attempt anything like it, even though I feel like there'd be some pieces of cinema that would actually benefit from having movies not operate in this, like, such a linear fashion.
Yeah.
Is it fascinating while you're watching it? Like, obviously you can't think about what was, like, the first time you watched it 5 years ago. I remember being kind of taken aback when I was 18 seeing it in theaters, but also, like, vibing with it, like, pretty hard.
Yeah. Well, I think I was in my mid to late 20s when I saw it. And you mentioned it earlier. It is taken, you know, like, the elements of it are interesting because, yes, it's adapted from an anime. It's adapted from a children's anime. And so I'm not going to speak like an expert on, like, anime and, like, live action because I have friends who would chastise me because I have not watched enough. But I think what really I pull from Speed Racer and its tone, its rhythm, and its visuals, and ultimately, like you said, your aesthetic, it's kinetic. And so for me, yeah, it's kinetic, and not just in visual image and edit, but it's kinetic in the way that it tells its story. And so I knew we were going to talk about this, and it's a great graph quote that she talks about where you mentioned the influence of cubism and this aesthetic assault and everything is that they were, what was she saying? I'm just going to read it real quick. Talking about adults. And so I think this is where them adapting a children's anime, children's cartoon, essentially, it's kind of like you take your favorite singer or songwriter and say they could sing anything and it would sound good. You know? Yeah. I think I've heard people, I've probably said it myself. You could, like, Fiona Apple could sing just people's tweets and it would sound great, you know? You know, one, because of her cadence and inflection and things and her aggression. And two, also because that's sort of how she writes songs. And so I think, like, thinking about that with, like, the Wachowskis is like, I think you could literally give the Wachowskis any piece of material and they could adapt it, because they're not necessarily thinking about the material itself. They're thinking how that material becomes film. And I think that's what's really interesting, because they're not thinking of strict adaptation. They're thinking of, like, and this is where, you know, you're in the hands of a good artist. They're thinking of how, like, this thing communicates to an audience. And so
they're thinking of interpretation, not adaptation.
Exactly. Yeah. Or translation. Like, I went to seminary.
Translation. Yeah.
Yeah. I went to seminary, and one of my favorite things was learning Hebrew and Greek. Not to flex or anything, it's just part of the thing, you know. And
but you flex it.
Right. You know, I have many facets to who I am.
Absolutely.
But the thing that was really interesting to me was to be able to take these, like, what is our relationship to these objects? What is my relationship to the Old Testament? What is my relationship to these? And you would take these texts that were, like, mostly intact and et cetera, and translate them. And you're literally having to ask yourself each, maybe not each word, but each sentence, going back to how she refers to the grammar of cinema, editing as a sentence. And you're looking for ways to make this thing palatable, and palatable in the sense of not just how can you, like, swallow it easily, but palatable in the sense of, like, how does it communicate to you? And I think that's where they get on this quote. They talk about, you know, Picasso showing Guernica and, like, they being chased out by an angry mob, and her citation was they wanted to kill him. And why? Because of adults. Because adults often, as they age, and again, going back to so much of what we've already talked about, as they age, in their experience, they don't gain a wisdom of, like, living. They gain, like, a crystallization of their experience, and so they hold on to that. And so what she cites is, because of adults, they reject change, and an aesthetic change is too aggressive a death for them. And this is a great quotation. Every generation experiences aesthetic death. When you really assault an aesthetic, people freak out. But we said that kids are okay with aesthetic change. And I think, to me, you know, like, this is a quote pulled from an archival interview. She could be bullshitting. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
She could have absolutely said, like, made the movie and then give this reason as to why the movie is what it is post, you know, reception. But I think it does signal this sensation within that movie that, like, we talk about aesthetic death, and, like, aesthetic death in a positive way. Not that you're killing a thing so it doesn't come back, but, you know, the Wachowskis, I mean, literally, it's in the title of their new movie, Resurrections. I mean, we think about these, like, life-animating things, you know, these resurrections. You know, from a death, you would hope a resurrection would come. And so, like, for me, when you watch something like Speed Racer, you are watching something that is completely of its own, on its own terms. And like I said, going back to what I said earlier, it's kinetic. Earlier in that graph, I know we keep quoting it and keep citing it, but, like, early in the graph, she says that we're visually thinking people. And I think that's a really astute way to put how we process information as visually thinking, because often we think about, when we think about ourselves thinking, we think about information, we think about text, we think about this, but our memories are in our minds because of image, you know, like, that's why pictures and film and images and this and that and art and whatever is so image based. And so I'm rambling, but I just think Speed Racer is in itself just a very pop film. You know, kids can see it. Like, literally, my oldest son, Everett, when I first showed him the movie, when the final race, which I think is one of the most beautiful pieces of filmmaking, you know, that final race, I've never seen him so viscerally react to a movie ever. And he still, I've never seen him react this way. Like, we can watch any random Pixar, Disney Plus, whatever. I have never seen him react to a sequence in a film like he did the end of that. Because, you know, what's funny is I reacted the same way when I first watched it. And I watched it by myself. And I might have watched it ashamedly on my computer. But I remember nearly throwing my computer across the room because it is so full of movement. And it's so full of life. And it's so full of the things that I think ultimately what I love about the Wachowskis is they're very corny filmmakers. Sincere, earnest, and superficial as you can be, but all that superficiality is full of idea, is full of image idea. And I think their build, their edit, their montage, like down the line is just nearly pitch perfect, especially in Speed Racer, to the point where you get this visceral physical reaction to this thing that you can be watching on a tiny phone screen, honestly, or you can be watching with a crowd of 120 people, which you'll do soon, and you can have seen it 20 times and still your gut just churns. And I think what they were getting at with this aesthetic death and this aesthetic assault and this aggression and everything is like they can wield these things so with such capability that they can turn anything into something that sparks your imagination. Yeah, I'll leave it at that and let you talk. But like that's I think about that a lot.
Yes, no, that final race is a perfect illustration of exactly what you're talking about. And that kineticism and that like viscerality of just like the last race in itself is like its own sort of like short film. Like it really is just like
absolutely,
like
yeah.
Establishes stakes. There's a low point. I'm sure you could draw a whole story circle about the last race in Speed Racer or whatever.
And it's avant-garde.
It's very avant-garde.
Experimental,
like,
yeah.
After the low point of the race, Speed essentially like comes into his like pathos as a character. Like he literally like fulfills his like namesake.
I was
like,
literally his name is
film.
Speed Racer.
His name is Speed Racer. The film becomes like abstraction at points. Like it's no longer a literal race. Like the things you are seeing on screen are not the same things that like people are actually experiencing in the stadium. Like it is a visual illustration of what is happening inside like Speed's soul. Yeah. I guess you would say his heart. Like,
absolutely.
You know, like every part of him that is like bursting forward to like do something that no one has ever done before. And like that is them, the Wachowskis, trying to illustrate that on screen. Because like how do you illustrate something on screen of like someone is going to literally break the fabric of what you understand about an art form.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be something you've never seen before. And so how do you do that? Well, you kind of break the fabric of the art form in which you're trying to illustrate a character breaking the fabric of an art form. And so
to watch a character do it as they're doing it is it, again, this like very layered thing. It's so absolutely, you're right.
And we say it so matter of fact as if that's not the most like the most difficult thing to do as a film. I mean, there's a joke about Mr. Holland's Opus, which is like you should never ever have heard the song in Mr. Holland's Opus because it's a thing he's been writing for like decades, and then when you hear it, it's kind of not good. It's really funny. It's not good at all. And so it's really, really hard as a filmmaker. Like you have to portray, you know, something artistic, you know, the best art thing in the world as excitingly as it was, at the time it was being created or whatever. Like that's why I like the movie Pollock so much. Like it really does get into like that kineticism of like, well, what is this art form of painting like Jackson Pollock? It's like, well, like it's very physical. It's very like monotonous and focused, you know, all these things. And like, you know, I think Ed Harris does like a great job as a director and a performer, like illustrating that. And so it really does like pull me into this world of, yes, I'm sure that's not what it was actually like for Jackson Pollock. I'm sure it was something completely different. But me as an audience member, as a viewer, like I at least get the idea as like a feeling, as like a very visceral feeling.
Yeah.
And so, that like Last Race and Speed Racer is like a perfect illustration of that. And, you know, I know we've talked a lot about like the deeper, more philosophical aspects of aesthetic. I think, you know, at the time, the things that were leveled against it being like headache inducing and like, I think all those things are obviously not the case. I actually do think it's a very pleasant movie to look at in its artifice.
Absolutely.
Because there's a bad version of this and they're like the children's Robert Rodriguez movies.
Whoa.
I know.
I love Robert Rodriguez.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay,
no. Here's the thing. I love Robert Rodriguez. Yeah. I'm just saying aesthetically, Shark Boy and Lava Girl are cousins to Speed Racer, but there's
I get what you're saying, yeah. I will defend my boy, though. Yeah,
I love Robert Rodriguez. I've seen Alita Battle Angel more times than I'm willing to admit.
Because Robert Rodriguez is sort of an antecedent for the Wachowskis making Speed Racer. They just, you know, have the tools and maybe the deeper
pockets.
Deeper pockets, for sure. That's funny. I think when it comes to Speed Racer, kind of one thing we're getting on, you know, you'd mentioned like green screens and digital filmmaking and kind of, because it was... When was Collateral made again? 2007?
I thought it was like 2005.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. But we were like, digital cinema was new at this point, you know? And, you know, just looking back, it is this completely green screen movie that, like, you know, we can scoff at most green screen films because they're uninteresting. I mean, Speed Racer was the Wachowskis in, like, this total control moment. I don't want to theorize too much or get, like, academic or cerebral, but, like, to me, anything in a image captured as an actor, I think they got that the green screens and these things were these objects that could contend also with the actual living humans on film. Whereas you watch whatever, just run-of-the-mill superhero movie, the green screens are not not used in these ways that give them life. There's a lot of interesting things you could do with digital filmmaking and a green screen. I mean, and these mocap, you know, like all these devices that are used to just push out swill, you know, like the Wachowskis kind of just sort of perfected in one movie, you know? And that's another thing I really like is to watch them in total control. Because, like, let's be honest, Neil Hirsch could have been anybody.
Absolutely. And it almost was.
Literally could have been anybody. It doesn't matter who sits in that seat because it's not them in control. Like, the Wachowskis are just master puppeteers in this sense. And so, one thing I talk about with a lot of people when I talk about movies, and I'll try not to get too heady or too off on this subject because I could talk about it forever, is like the psychic space of an image. When you're paying attention, when you know how to form image, when you know how to like bring to life something that is essentially in itself a still frame, when you know how to do that, you know how to make a movie. I would just consider most filmmakers now just don't know how to do that. They don't know how to bring life to a movie. And so many of the good things about Speed Racer, you could just watch it over and over. It's one of the most rewatchable movies. It's fun, and we like to have fun at movies. You can choose to follow its deeper philosophical rhythms, or you can choose not to. Either way, you can be in an audience with a bunch of people and still have a blast. You can watch it with kids, and I think, you know, if you're privy to children's movies and, you know, modern animation and things, they're uninspiring. Most of them are very boring. They're very didactic. The rhythms of the narrative are implied are very, you know, from a screenplay book. I mean, all these things. And then you get Speed Racer, which is a kid's movie. It's an adult's movie. It's a literal, just general audience movie, and you don't get any of those, not in that way. I mean, you may never get something like that again, that literally you can have a whole crowd, like you said earlier. Just, I think it's really just pure spectacle in the way that that's exciting. And, you know, you want more of it. You know, you watch something like Speed Racer, not to be crude, but to think about that last race. The first thing that came to my mind in that last race when, like, Speed, like, finishes the race, everybody's freaking out, like, he wins the race, and the car, like, pulls into frame, like, screeches into frame in this close-up. And you watch the wheels melting, you know, they're dripping.
Yeah.
The rubber is literally melting. To me, it was like, this is orgasmic, you know, like literally.
Yeah.
It's the shot. You
is
know
this
what I'm
like
saying?
Orgasmic release? Yeah.
The money shot. It literally, like, without it, you don't have the sequence. And I think it in a way, it's them in total control of a movie because it tells you in that moment, the thing is done. You can breathe now. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Because you have been just tense. But another brilliant thing about that sequence, because it's kind of this like perfect, like final bit to that movie, is like it all has antecedent. And I already said that word. I don't know why I keep saying it, but it all has like prior knowledge within the narrative of the film. So like, you know what these cars can do. You've seen them do it. You've seen these devices that are used to like make a racer crash or make somebody win the race. And then you see them, like you were saying earlier, in this way that like everything just melts. And so like you have this like narrative logic to it, but they give you this like very experimental, and I don't want to oversell it, but this definitely avant-garde like piece of like mainstream cinema that like feels right and makes sense. You know, like they just pull together so much, you know, it's like, it really is just like watching a totality of movie making.
Well, it really does.
I'm sorry, I know we're just rambling.
Margo, this is, you have no, like, I'm going to listen to this audio. It's going to be like ASMR for me. Like, like, oh, thank, just keep talking.
Oh, no, not me.
You said it feels like this totality of cinema, and in a way you're like right, because to me there have been other movies that have crossed certain like cinematic thresholds since Speed Racer came out. Obviously, I know there are people who are way deeper into the art house scene than I'm in, that I'm sure they could be like, oh, there's been so many films that have played the MoMA that have like pushed boundaries and things like that. But as far as something that was meant for a populace to see,
absolutely,
it really does feel like the last time someone tried to innovate cinema from the ground up with as many resources as they possibly could. And that is why, you know, despite me, you know, I'm an unabashed Wachowski person. They have done no wrong. And I know people would probably disagree with me. But to me, this is why this has been the peak of their creative output, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels like they reached for something and they got it. And ever since that moment, everything else has been experiments and digressions to other avenues that have been equally as delightful and enlightening. And I'll watch Cloudless and Jupiter Ascending until I die. But this really does feel like they shot for the stars and they hit a galaxy.
Yeah.
Almost.
You're so right. I mean, just to even like look at a thing and say, yeah, they got it. Pitch perfect. I mean, it's a long movie, but it's enjoyable all throughout. I mean, I don't mean that as a knock on it. I mean, it's literally a movie you could just like, you're engaged, enthralled, and like in it every moment. Which is, you know, getting to its like anime roots. I mean, people have cited this before. It's like a perfect live action anime. I mean, it's just so.
It really is. Like, you don't have to feel. I know your friends might make fun. No, but it really is.
I love anime.
Like,
I'm just not as, you know, versed.
But like, it's all the elements of an anime that I enjoy, from the sincerity and the unreality of it, and like the delightful two dimensions of the characters in anime. Like, I love all those things. Those are all features, not bugs for me.
Yeah.
And then it's that, you know, we say a lot, it's the kineticism.
Yeah.
And that is something that I think is missing. I think people shy away from kineticism in cinema because people are always probably too afraid to be like it's too choppy, you can't follow it. That there's a difference between choppiness and kineticism.
Absolutely, because this is a smooth movie. This is not. Yeah,
it's very smooth.
Very smooth movie, yeah.
Well, it's almost like the thing, like I remember when I was way into the production of Mad Max, when that came out, or Fury Road, when that came out. And, you know, I was obsessed with the idea that, like, you know, there were two things. It was that George Miller would always talk about how they put, like, a crossbar, like, bullseye on the camera, and they were like, if you center everything in the middle of the frame, the eye can follow it, and so when you edit for the middle of the frame, which is what his wife Margaret Sixel did for the movie. So it's like, you know, this movie that is very kinetic and like very like full of life, Mad Max, very easy to follow, very smooth, like your eye can follow from thing to thing. And I don't think Speed Racer is any more different than that. Yeah, like sure, at some points there are like multiple sliding heads going across the screen, and, you know, multiple people talking in multiple different languages. But the way it is, like, sewn together, like, you would never say, like, I can't follow anything. Like, this is moving too fast. Like, that would never be the case.
Yeah, because again, they give you, in a movie, they give you a movie that you haven't seen before and you'll never see like it again. They give you the terms. They give you the, like, way to follow. And then they just like slowly but surely amp that up. That's the thing, you know, like you talk about aesthetic death and you talk about this thing, like, and that talk about the sense of like they're thinking of these things as language, and they think it like they literally like took this thing, this film, and said, like, here's a language. It's like watching Lord of the Rings and like hearing the elven language or whatever that J.R.R. Tolkien like made. It's just one of those things, like you're watching somebody do that in a movie and you're like having to track with it in a visual sense, not in a, you know, verbal sense. So, but they teach you how to watch the movie while you're watching it. And then by the time you get to it, that's why it's like, that's why I say it's orgasmic, is because it's like they gave you everything you needed in this movie to know how to watch it, to know how to process it, because they understood, like, again, going back to that sense of like, we're making a movie of truly about stream of consciousness. And so like, they somehow, again, going back to what I was saying here, psychically connect with people in an audience, and they understand what it looks like to connect with a group of people who are going there to watch a movie, because they understand like what spectacle is, and they understand like how to communicate in that way. And it's like, that's why I think it's so, like, they're masters, because they know how to communicate in the language of spectacle. And like, I love spectacle. I am an absolute whore for spectacle. That's why I have the obsessions and the Instagram that I do. It's just the thing I love. Like,
oh, I know, and I love it.
You know, I know you can't trust celebrities, and as far as you can throw them, da da da. Like, you don't have to give me the common things. Like, For me, it's just like, I am a creature born of the century and time I was born in, and like, I want to be talked to in that way, and I want to be talked to in an intelligent way. And this felt like a way that was acknowledging that, but also doing it intelligently. And for me, that's just an incredible thing to do. And to be able to, like, I mean, like you said earlier, it's so hard to just make a movie. And to make a movie that does what this does, I mean, it is genuinely a miracle of art making, because it's so unique. And so you'll never have it again. And I think what you said earlier, sort of like Touch of Evil, I'm not trying to be grandiose, sort of like Touch of Evil was like the end of film noir as a style. The Speed Racer definitely does feel like it was like unintentionally so, you know, regrettably so, not because of them or the movie itself, but because of like commercial, you know, enterprise in the industry itself, but like was a final thing. It felt like a last thing.
Yeah.
In a way that is like very sad, and that people didn't learn the right lessons from.
Yeah. It feels as if we get things that people kind of compare to Speed Racer, it almost feels like they're a coup, like as like, uh-huh. Oh my God, like they snuck this, somehow they snuck this little element through the studio system. Speed Racer feels like a film that was made with like a bunch of studio executives just looked at these two people and were like, yep, sure, go ahead, do it. Like no oversight, just like go ahead. Like yeah. Joel says we can trust you, so just go ahead and make your weird anime movie. $120 million, that's how much great. That's, you can have whatever you want.
And I don't, like, we might not have time to talk about this, but I was reading an article earlier that I mentioned to you before we started recording, Joel Silver's interview with him, and how the branding of this movie was like set about, because they literally, I don't remember this because I don't remember when the movie came out. I don't remember, but like they literally had Speed Racer on everything, any product placement you can think of, not in the movie necessarily, but like cereal, this and that, whatever you buy at your local grocery store. It was like an onslaught of product development and synchronization with this movie that, like, it's, again, there's this whole other conversation to be had about the Wachowskis and like their significant and very singular place within the commercial art world that, to me, just like, you could just go hours about it, but it's so fascinating to even consider.
There's a whole book to be written. That's simply true, yeah. About their like relationship to the commercial art world, and they themselves as like anti-capitalist leftist filmmakers making transgressive experimental art. Like, absolutely. There's just a whole book on just that one topic. You wouldn't even have to go into anything else.
Nope, it's all there.
Because I don't think there is, you know, not to like use a worn out phrase, there is no one else like them. Like no, there is no, like,
not.
There's them. And then there's also like this person who's kind of like that. Like, no, there's the intersection of big budgets and transgressive filmmaking, like do not intersect in that way, except for these two people. So yeah,
absolutely.
God bless them.
Yeah.
Margo, I have two last questions to ask of you, okay. And then I will let you go.
Sure.
And so all I want to ask is, because I had you on, like I said, you are a very visual person. Please do not stop what you are doing. I learned so much about fashion and aesthetic, like from just following your Instagram and just you personally. So when I ask of you is, what does aesthetic mean to you?
Oh, what a question. Aesthetic to me is going back to something we've talked about, and I actually wrote about this a little bit recently in relationship to my transness in fashion. You know, aesthetic to me is language. Aesthetic to me is language, and it can be developed, it can be undeveloped, it can be, you know, pure, it can be clear and concise, it can be confusing and obtuse. But I think to me, aesthetic ultimately is the language we adopt to communicate with other people, you know, that finds its place into how we dress, the way we interact with people. It finds its way into how people interact with us, if we're talking about, you know, movie making. So aesthetic to me is just purely language, and like adopting that from the things around you, the objects and the senses. It's a very sensorial thing to me. And some people have developed aesthetic, some people don't. It's okay either way. But yeah, I don't know if that's a good answer, but...
That is a great answer.
Okay.
There's no wrong answer to a question like
sure,
that.
Sure, I just want to give a good answer.
No, I mean, you are very good at communicating, so aesthetics tying into communication and how we interact with each other, like, I think that is a perfect definition for you.
Okay, good.
Obviously, we could wrap up thoughts on Speed Racer, but I think people know enough about our thoughts on Speed Racer. So
yeah.
I just want to ask you, for the audience, where can people follow you? What do you want people to know about you?
Okay.
Do you have any upcoming projects? Will you resurrect anything?
Oh, gosh. So sometimes I collaborate with friends at Super Yaki, which is, you can find them on Twitter and Instagram at Super YAKI.
At this point, they're almost broken into the mainstream because they've had people like Judy Greer like wear their merch and stuff.
Which
like...
is so funny. It's just crazy to watch. I mean, Andrew, the guy who runs it, is a absolute doll and sweetheart, and I love him to death.
Yeah.
Sometimes I collaborate with them. I will not be bringing the shirt store back at any point because I just don't want to, but you can follow my Instagram at MisenSen. It's at MisenSene. Wow, lots of vowels. And I don't know what else is coming up. I think, like, I want to... This conversation we have is in line and in the spirit of a lot of conversations I've been having lately, and I just feel the need to create myself, and so I'm hoping to, like, write a movie and collaborate with some people soon. I don't mean that in the most humble sense. Like, I don't even know what that means, but it's something I want to do, and so I hope that happens. Other than that, I don't know.
That's great. I just think more people, regardless of the store existing or not, I think you are just a presence people should follow. As
oh,
I said,
thank you.
I think there is, in film world, there aren't a lot of people. I would say you and Angelica Jade Bastian are two people who come to mind immediately. It's like people who focus on, like, the physicality.
Yeah, what company?
The, like,
I love
looks
her so
of people.
Much, okay.
Oh, God, if I could just sit and talk to her for a little bit. I know she's just over in Chicago, but, like,
yeah.
I would love to sit and talk to her for hours. But, like, people who write and talk and exhibit things more to do with, like, aesthetics, with physicality, with looks, with, you know, those types of things. I think you are a good presence for that on the internet.
Oh, thank you.
I think more people should get into it, because cinema isn't all text and subtext.
It's not.
You got to move away from that.
I get bored very quickly, so yeah. I have to find other things to talk about.
I love text and subtext, but I'm getting to an age where I'm like, well, that's why we wrote books.
Yeah. Well, and I'm very glad we didn't spend a whole podcast episode on just talking about the Wachowskis and transness. We really did. I think we talked about, which we could have done, which is people
we could
do,
have easily.
But yeah, like...
Look, people and artists are mosaics.
Yes.
Them being trans is just one piece of that mosaic.
Absolutely.
And I like to look at that piece sometimes,
yeah,
but
for
there
sure.
are many other pieces I like to look at too. So
yeah.
Thank you so much, Margo. I will have you on. You have what I call an open invitation, meaning like you could just bust into my DMs and be like, yo, they're playing this movie. I'm on that episode.
Okay.
Bye. Like, I'd just be like, I have to shrug and be like, all right, Margo's on.
Now that we've popped our cherry, definitely. I want to be on again. This is fun.
Absolutely,
Margo.
You're a delightful
host.
Thank you. Oh, thank you so much, Margo.
Yeah.
It's been a joy having you. Thank you so much for that. Me and Margo had never talked outside of DMs on Instagram, so like this was the first time we had like a back and forth conversation with our voices and faces, and it felt like talking to a kindred spirit. As I said, she has carte blanche and an open invitation back to the podcast anytime she wants. I hope she comes back soon. Follow her on Instagram at MisenSen. You will not be disappointed. And that's going to do it for me this week on A Place for Film. I'd like to thank Brittany Friesner and Alicia Cosma for letting me do this podcast every week, and the support of the IU Cinema for letting me do this podcast. I'd like to thank Steve Alford and Irrational Discourse for the use of our theme song, which probably wasn't used this week, but still worthy of a thanks. Please remember to follow the IU Cinema on the various social media outlets, generally at IU Cinema or at Indiana University Cinema. You can find me on Twitter at Samurai Flicks, on Instagram at Robert Dolphy for the time being, and on Letterboxd at Robert Dolphy. And I'm very excited for the screening. I really do hope I see some of your faces out there. This has been kind of a dream come true to get this screened in Bloomington at one of my favorite places on earth. And it's going to be a cool week. So with that, This has been A Place for Film. I will 100% see you at the movies. Good night.